know what I was thinking about?
No, what?
The number of seconds there are in an average lifetime.
Yeah.
And you know what I was thinking? It's a brand new year. And with all those seconds to fill, why not spend some of them in 1987? I'm Carrie Thompson, and from the sound of it, life 25 years ago was a bit weird. We have an interview with the late River Phoenix talking about his formative years.
We didn't have any money, so it was kind of shaky sometimes. We always had food, though.
We also have some close encounters as seen from the cockpit of a 747 at 35,000 feet.
As it entered U.S. airspace at the junction of the Canadian border and the Beaufort Sea, the pilot reported seeing unusual white and yellow flashing lights.
And if that's not disorienting enough, we have an interview with beat poet Allen Ginsberg.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving mystical naked.
And no, he wasn't talking about River Phoenix. It's a long, strange trip back to 1987 and a brand new year here on Playback. Let's start her up with Noah Adams and Ira Flato.
You know, Noah, sometimes this job is just so stressful that I just have to have something to kind of make me feel better, you know?
What have you got there?
This plastic bubble stuff. You know, you find it in packing material.
Right.
It's like, oh, God. You want some? I got plenty of this stuff. I got loads of it.
This is a pretty noisy... I see people doing this from time to time. It's a pretty noisy way to relieve tension, actually, but it is fascinating to do.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Doesn't that feel better? Oh, this is good stuff, too. This is really good stuff. You know, I just don't believe that people actually believe that we're sitting here live on the radio doing this with these bubbles. What do you think?
That's true. That's true.
Do you believe that we're sitting here live? Actually, there are these two guys from New Jersey, Michael and Ken Ewing, who are actually marketing this stuff. They're selling it as stuff called grief relief.
Grief relief.
Yeah. Sell it in sheets.
Why would you pay them money for something that you could just sort of pick up around the office?
Well, I guess that's the question that the stockholders of their company are going to have to answer. But I have a feeling that there are actually hundreds of thousands of people out there right now popping these bubbles to make themselves feel better. And this is for you folks.
By the way, the last Monday of January is Bubble Wrap Appreciation Day. And now for a story about Ronald Reagan's January 1987 medical procedure.
In a brief statement, Dr. John Hutton said it was a very routine transurethral resection. There was nothing out of the ordinary, he added, and noted the preliminary view of all specimens shows no sign of cancer. Today's prostate surgery was the second medical procedure to be performed on the president in as many days. Yesterday, Mr. Reagan had four small polyps removed from his colon. White House spokesman Larry Speke said that an examination showed the polyps were benign as expected. Results of a biopsy on the tissue removed from the president this morning will be made available tomorrow. Speke said the president was awake during the prostate surgery. He said it was performed under a spinal anesthetic that numbs the lower body without making the patient unconscious. The president was visited early this morning by White House Chief of Staff Donald Regan. According to Speaks, the president and Regan went over some briefing papers, and Regan wished the president good luck. The terse statement released by the White House today regarding Mr. Reagan's health contrasts with the extended briefings given after Mr. Reagan underwent major cancer surgery in July 1985. Then, the doctors were military surgeons at the Naval Hospital. This time, the procedures were performed by doctors brought in from the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. But Speaks rejected suggestions that First Lady Nancy Reagan wanted civilian doctors so that she could limit information about the 75-year-old president's health. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
And naturally, we segue from the presidential medical procedures to a startling revelation from a member of the British House of Lords. It seems that instead of donating his body to science, a certain Lord Avebury wanted his deceased self to go to the dogs, literally. Here's reporter Vera Frankel.
British animal lovers make all kinds of bequests to the Battersea Dogs Home, a refuge for mutts that's almost a national institution. But this is the first time they've been offered a corpse, and a distinguished corpse at that. Lord Avebury, a liberal life peer who's also a Buddhist, is in fact still very much alive. But he started moves to bequeath his body to the Dogs Home kitchens. It is, he insists, quite logical. He believes that anything that's biodegradable should be recycled, and that includes him. Sadly, the manager of the dog's home, Bill Wadman Taylor, isn't too receptive to the idea. He says, "I'm sure there's a lot of nutritional value in the noble lord, and the dogs aren't fussy, but we just couldn't do it." Lord Avebury's lawyer is being equally difficult, refusing to include the bequest in a will. As for members of Lord Avebury's family, well, they find it all a bit distasteful, and they think he's barking mad. But he's optimistic that he can make them change their minds by means of financial pressure, though he says he'll stop short of disinheriting them altogether. Lord Avebury seems vaguely bemused that his generous offer should be causing such a fuss. After all, he says, surely it's a nice gesture to give the doggies a good meal and think of the saving on dog food. For National Public Radio, I'm Vera Frankel in London.
Now it's time to roll out some brand new technology, circa 1987. Here's Bob Edwards.
Washington has just seen the future on the small screen. Yesterday, federal regulators and members of Congress got a first-hand view of what broadcasters hope will be the television picture of tomorrow. It's so crisp and clear, it looks more like a photograph than television. But the technology for it requires changes in the spectrum of current broadcasting frequencies. Getting those changes will not be easy due to stiff competition for unused frequencies, which are diminishing in number. Michael Richards reports.
It's being called the television picture of the 21st century, named high-definition TV. The Japanese already have plans in place to make it available to people with satellite dishes in 5 years and to the general public later. In this country, broadcasters think it's a good idea, too. Dan Gold, the president of Knight Ridder Broadcasting, is a big booster of high-definition, or HD TV.
HD TV is, in fact, as significant as the move we made when we went from black and white to color. No question.
HDTV was demonstrated yesterday in Washington for members of Congress and for the Federal Communications Commission.
And now the grand aerial salute to all the participants in the games of the 23rd Olympiad.
Side-by-side projection TV showed highlights from the 1984 Los Angeles Summer Olympics. One screen used current technology, the other high-definition technology. There was no question. High-definition TV took the gold, silver, and bronze medals. The blues were bluer, the purples more intense, the reds truer, and the grass was so lush, it looked like the gardener had imported sod from the lawns of England. The standard TV looked pale by comparison, its picture a little bit fuzzy. Jim McKinney heads the Mass Media Bureau at the FCC.
HDTV is a reality today. It is now becoming quickly a standard throughout the world for production, not only of video production for television, but also for the motion picture industry. The question, of course, is how will it be distributed to the consumers?
All TVs will still work as they do now, but to benefit from high-definition television, consumers will have to buy specially equipped sets. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards in Washington.
Now, as it turns out, bandwidth was a problem with HDTV in 1987, as was figuring out how to compress all that data. And it wasn't until July 23, 1996, that the first HDTV transmission took place in Raleigh, North Carolina. And what better to watch on your non-HDTV set than delightful movies with our featured actor, River Phoenix. Here's Lynn Neary with an interview.
River.
Lynn.
You're only 16, right?
Only 16. Only 16. She was too young to fall in love, and I was too old to know. Sam Cooke's song.
River Phoenix may behave like any other 16-year-old when he chooses to, but his on-screen performances so far reveal a surprising maturity for such a young actor. River first won critical acclaim in Rob Reiner's film Stand By Me. He played Chris Chambers, a troubled but sensitive kid who seemed to understand more about life than his young friends.
You're just a kid, Gordy. Oh, gee, thanks, Dad. Wish the hell I was your dad. You wouldn't be going around talking about taking these stupid shop courses if I was. It's like God gave you something, man. All those stories that you can make up. And he said, this is what we got for you, kid. Try not to lose it. But kids lose everything unless there's someone there to look out for them. And if your parents are too f- to do it, then maybe I should.
The path that River Phoenix took to Hollywood is as unusual as his name. He is the oldest son of John and Arlen Phoenix. Their other children are Summer, Rainbow, Leaf, and Liberty. Born in a log cabin in Oregon, River spent his early years living in communes in the Northwest. In 1973, his parents decided to become missionaries and move to South America. River and his sister Rainbow made their performing debut there, singing in the streets and at airports and hospitals.
We were so young, the guitar was bigger than I was, and in these Latin American countries, I guess it's not every day that they see two blonde kids with blue eyes, you know, singing songs in Spanish. So it was really, I think, unique.
Disenchanted with their church, John and Arlen Phoenix moved their family back to the United States. They had no money when they arrived in California, but the whole family had great hopes of making it big in Hollywood. And eventually, the Phoenix kids began getting jobs in commercials and on television. Most recently, River played the son of Harrison Ford in Mosquito Coast, a role that had some uncanny parallels to his own life. It's the story of a man who uproots his family and moves them to the jungle for a simpler life. A lot about making the film, says River, reminded him of his own childhood in South America.
We didn't have any money, so it was kind of shaky sometimes. We always had food, though. In a country like that, with that climate, there's always some fresh fruit on a tree nearby. So we just learned to sleep under the coconut tree and dodge the coconuts, and then once they land, we would eat them. So that kept us alive for a long time.
Just coconut milk?
Coconut milk and coconuts and other fruits like mangoes and bananas. There was a lot of good stuff down there.
What is it like for you now that you are successful in movies and I imagine can buy whatever you want? I mean, it must be a tremendous contrast for you now.
Our whole family's never been material, really. So, I mean, so many people have said, you know, why don't you have a car now? You're 16. It's not that important to me. I will get a car when I need one, but right now I don't need one, so I'll hold off until I need one. And I like good food. Good quality food is nice to have. And having a hot shower is great. So it's nice having that luxury.
The luxury of a hot shower.
Hot shower and a nice bed and warm blankets in a cold climate.
It's interesting to me to hear you say that what you want right now is a hot shower in a cold climate, because I just imagine you sort of surrounded by all the trappings of Hollywood, and that seems like a pretty simple desire in that setting.
Okay, so maybe I exaggerated a little. It's not that precious to me, but yeah, showers are great. I like hot showers. Really relaxing.
What do you think you've learned from your parents and the way that they chose to live their lives?
I think I've learned that being really close in a family is important. My parents have always treated me almost like a brother or a sister, and they've always been honest with me, and I've always been secure with them, knowing that they would always be there. And that's a real important thing for a kid to have, is security in his parents and trust. So I think that there are many ideals that I would like to hold on to if I ever have any kids.
I get the sense that you take your acting pretty seriously. I mean, it's something that's real important to you. Is that right?
Yeah.
And I wonder what would happen if you became sort of a teen idol.
I don't really want to be a star. I want to be an artist.
River Phoenix. He's only 16, but he seems to be on the road to stardom, whether he likes it or not. His next film, due out this spring, is Jimmy Reardon.
On October 31st, in 1993, River Phoenix collapsed and died of a drug overdose. He was 23 years old. In 1957, poet Allen Ginsberg rented himself a small furnished room in San Francisco and spent 6 months stooped over a secondhand typewriter. He wrote a poem called Howl,
Now considered one of the landmark works of contemporary American poetry, Ginsberg talked to NPR's Scott Simon.
It is still not clear to me when I read through the press material if a little over 30 years ago you hold yourself up in San Francisco because there was something that you had to write, or if you hold yourself up and eventually this is what you wrote.
Well, I tell you, I wrote a little preface which gives you a good explanation, so maybe I read from that because that's the most concise way I can put it.
Okay.
Howl was written in a furnished room at 1010 Montgomery Street, a few houses up from where the street meets Broadway in San Francisco, in North Beach, and continues down a few steep blocks into the financial district. I had a second-hand typewriter and some cheap scratch paper, so I began typing, not with the idea of writing any formal poem, but just stating my imaginative sympathies, whatever they were worth, as my loves were impractical and my thoughts relatively unworldly. I had nothing to gain, only the pleasure of enjoying on paper those sympathies most intimate to myself and most awkward in the greater world of family and formal education and business and current literature. What? So that's it. What I wrote that afternoon is this facsimile, which is presented in this book, this later edition of Howl.
What you wrote that afternoon is one of the most famous first lines in American poetry.
Yeah, and the line, for readers who may or may not be familiar, is, "I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, mystical, naked." And then in this facsimile edition, you'll see that I change it, "starving, hysterical, naked."
Did you change it? Because the version I have says "starving, hysterical, naked."
Yeah, but if you look in the facsimile, see, that's the whole point of this book. This is the original draft, which you'll find on page 12. "I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, mystical, naked."
I have heard it said that all the time, the 6 months you spent writing Howl in San Francisco, you weren't really convinced that it would ever be printed publicly.
Well, I wrote it. I didn't intend to print it to begin with. It was just a little private thing for me in my ear and my heart and maybe Kerouac. I think I sent him the original manuscript.
Jack Kerouac?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He sort of taught me to write, and it was his notion of spontaneous outpouring that turned me on to a more open form of writing than I had before. But on the other hand, so open I wouldn't want my family to see it.
Let me stop you there for a second. Yeah. When you say an open form of outpouring,
yeah,
something you spend 6 months writing, that's not an open form of outpouring. It's disciplined, it's crafted, it's polished.
Well, yes and no, but it all depends on this original impulse to, you know, say what you got on your heart and say it completely the first time. Then you might fix it up, as you can see I have quite a bit.
Yeah.
But this was a sort of discovery to me to sit down and write what I really thought instead of trying to write a poem. Just write down what I thought. And since I had all sorts of images of homosexuality in the poem, that I didn't want my family to see it, and so in a way I was liberated from the problem of publication. I just thought I wouldn't publish, I'd just write whatever I felt like. When you're talking to yourself in bed at night in the dark and you don't make any sound, I mean, do those thoughts, do you want other people to overhear you? No. So I wanted to write, I mean, I just started writing in that mode, and it didn't occur to me to publish until after I'd written it and after I shaped it up a little bit, and then we were invited to give a poetry reading with a bunch of younger wild poets that were really great, like Gary Snyder and Philip Whalen and Michael McClure and Philip LaMantilla, with Kenneth Rexroth as the MC in an art gallery in 55 in San Francisco. And I had this little document, and it was way off in San Francisco, far from my family, so I thought that would be fun to read. Then we had to worry about censorship, and we ran into that, too. The customs seized the book when it was printed in England.
Well, it was printed in England before
the
United States?
In those days, it was cheaper to print in England than in the United States for a marginal, small public. We only printed 500 copies, you know, or 1,000 maybe at the most. Just, you know, a little pamphlet of poems for local use in San Francisco and maybe sell 200 or something.
But they seized it at customs?
Yeah, they seized it at customs, the nuts.
Because
dirty. But the American Civil Liberties Union had read the manuscript and said, "Well, it's a poem, you can't seize that. It's a violation of free speech." So they were going to take it up, but the customs inspector, a guy named Chester McPhee, finally gave up and let it go. But by then it was in the newspaper that they had seized it. And so there was some trouble, but people started buying it. And so then the local juvenile vice squad cops came around to City Lights bookshop and arrested the clerk, an old friend of mine, Shig Morau, and the Ferlinghetti, and dragged him down to jail for selling it.
Lawrence Ferlinghetti got busted for selling your poems?
He got busted, poor fellow. Well, he printed it, you know.
Yeah.
So then there was a trial, and the judge said, well, it's obviously a poem. You can't censor this. It has redeeming social commentary, and so therefore anything. It's free speech. The guy's talking about the culture. You can't... scholars of war, hydrogen jukeboxes, and things like that. He's criticizing nuclear scene or military budget. And just in time, in 1955, they were beginning to expand the military budget out of reason already. So... It was released, but by then the trial was in the newspapers and then hit the loose magazines. And so
loose magazines, you mean like Time and Life?
Yeah, and so the book began selling like hotcakes, so I have to thank the Vice people, as usual, for blundering into being my publicity agents.
Can I take the 3.5 we have left? Could it get you to play the harmonium?
Oh, yeah, maybe sing a little song that's from another book that is published
simultaneously. This one has just come out?
White Shroud.
White Shroud is your most recent collection of poetry, right? Yes.
And I'd be ashamed to put out something old like Howl if I didn't have some new poems to present. And from the book White Shroud, there's a song, Airplane Blues. But we don't have time to sing it, even though it's got some news. So I'll sing you just the best lines, one verse that I will choose. I'm alone in the sky where there's nothing to lose. The sun's not eternal, that's why there's the blues. Majestic old jailhouse, our joy's in the cage. Hearts full of hatred will outlast my old age.
Allen Ginsberg died in 1997. And now for a story from John Hockenberry.
Crew members of a Japan Airlines JAL cargo plane en route from Iceland to Anchorage, Alaska, say they encountered a large, unidentified flying object over the Arctic last November. The Federal Aviation Administration has been unable to find an explanation for what happened. But the pilot of the JAL plane says the strange and flashing lights must have belonged to something extraterrestrial, something he says was twice as large as an aircraft carrier. Tim Woolston of member station KSKA reports from Anchorage.
The incident began at 6:19 on the evening of November 17th. The JAL cargo plane was en route to Anchorage from Europe via Iceland on its way to Tokyo. As it entered U.S. airspace at the junction of the Canadian border and the Beaufort Sea, the pilot reported seeing unusual white and yellow flashing lights. The lights, he said, were approximately 8 miles away and at the same altitude as the JAL plane, 35,000 feet, traveling at the same speed and in the same direction. Pilot Kenju Taraichi asked the Air Traffic Control Center in Anchorage if there was any reported traffic in their vicinity. A controller replied that there wasn't, but added he did have an unidentified blip on his radar screen. As the lights continued to pace the 747, Taraichi says he descended from 35 to 31,000 feet to see if the UFO would follow, and it did. The blinking lights tracked the flight for about 50 minutes. Taraichi then made a 360-degree turn and reported losing contact with the UFO. Taraichi says because of the object's ability to start, stop, and change direction instantly, it could not have been of this Earth.
They moved rapidly and stopped suddenly. Humankind cannot control the inertia and the gravity.
The FAA says radar operators in Fairbanks picked up nothing on their screens in the vicinity of the 747, and a United Airlines flight spotted the JAL plane but saw nothing else in the sky nearby. FAA spokesman Paul Stuckey says the controller who reported seeing an unidentified blip following the 747 filed a routine account of the incident, maintaining there was something else there.
Then as a matter of the sighting itself, we went back and checked the radar and called the military and so forth. And that's when we discovered that, contrary to what he had said, we couldn't pick up anything on the radar regeneration. However, we're going back and looking at it again a little more carefully.
The FAA notified the Air Force within minutes of the sighting, but it's not known what, if anything, they did about it. Military officials have refused comment. The FAA interviewed the pilot and two-member crew upon arrival at Anchorage International, and Stuckey says it's clear they were not hallucinating or fabricating the story.
They were rational, professional, well-trained people, and they were not on any drugs or alcohol. All three of them reported seeing this lighted whatever, and there was no question with regard to their integrity.
The FAA plans to talk to the pilot again and will continue its review of the radar tapes. As for the month and a half it took for the public to find out about the incident, Stuckey says the FAA didn't exactly broadcast it until the media dug up the story. For National Public Radio, this is Tim Wolston in Anchorage, Alaska.
There has been a spacecraft sighted, flying high above the sky. Sirens declare there's one among us from Venus.
Volunteers, we need volunteers. Soldiers to meet them, have no fear, have no fear. You will be killed right away.
Okay, so to conclude this trippy edition of Playback, here's another guy with a flair for the strange. And let me remind you, in case there's any doubt, this story really did air on NPR.
You look at a grain of sand, close up, under a microscope.
Let me see.
Better fix it for your eye.
Okay. Yeah.
Looks a lot like a huge boulder, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Well, that's because it once was a boulder. A long time ago. Before it had any idea of becoming what it is now.
Beautiful.
Yeah, that's what it was, a big boulder that let go of some mountain somewhere, fell into the sea.
Wonder if anyone heard the splash.
What I wonder is how long did it take for it to become what it is now?
Yeah, how long would it take to become a grain of sand?
But how long do you figure it'd take?
Eons, I guess.
Assuming, of course, that a grain of sand could have a sense of its own identity and could think. How long would it take for it to figure out that what it really is, here in the immense design of things, is just a tiny piece of what makes a beach?
Hey, look at me, I'm a beach.
And if it could hypothecate something as abstract as a beach, do you think it could take the next inductive leap?
What would that be?
And imagine the existence of that ocean out there?
It does look like a boulder.
Let me tell you, for a tiny grain of sand, like the one you're staring at right now.
Beautiful.
For it to first figure out beach, and then figure out ocean. Well, that's a genius grain of sand.
You think it could ever figure out, well, ever know about the mountain it came from? Boulder it used to be.
I don't know.
It still looks like.
Probably not. Probably too busy.
Doing what?
Trying to get along.
With who?
All its neighbors. Grain of sand has a lot of neighbors.
Audio artist Ken Nordine. Oh, and by the way, here's the lowdown on that UFO.
The possibility that two Japanese pilots spotted an unidentified flying object in November is being ruled out by a scientific group based in Buffalo, New York. The pilots of the Japanese airline reported the unexplained sighting near Anchorage, Alaska. After analyzing the pilot's radio transmissions, Paul Kurtz, chairman of the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, has concluded the suspected UFO was probably a planet.
As far as we can see,
next month, it's February 87, Susan Stamberg talks to comedian Steve Allen. Robert Krulwich examines the upswing in condom sales. And the Car Talk Guys debut on Weekend Edition Sunday. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.